If you have a Bible this morning, I want to encourage you to turn to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16, the third Gospel, the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16. 40 years ago, this coming October, there was a group of men who gathered together. These men were not very normal men. In fact, they were very abnormal men. They did for their hobby and for their living, they lifted weights to such an extreme, they coined the phrase bodybuilders. They got together 40 years ago and they began a contest that we now know as Mr. Olympia, where the finest and the strongest weightlifters and bodybuilders in the world gather together to compete against one another. It was a contest that was much in obscurity for 10 years. Until 1975, there was a young man from Austria named Arnold Schwarzenegger who came to the picture. He won 6 straight years, retired from bodybuilding, and came back in 1985, and he won it again. 7 titles, Mr. Olympia, now Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Last decade, there was a man by the name of Lee Haney who matched Arnold's record. He won 7 Mr. Olympias. Only he didn't win them in 2 separate sets. He won them consecutively, 7 in a row. In 2 months, the 40th anniversary of Mr. Olympia will commence. There's a young man by the name of Ronnie Coleman. Ronnie Coleman is aiming for his 8th straight Mr. Olympia contest. He hails from Arlington, Texas. He's a mammoth man. He stands just shy of 6 foot tall, and he's over 300 pounds, and there is no fat on his body. Only this year's contest, as he competes against those men that he competes against all the time in other sub contests, there is a competitor that will be there from Russia. His name is Alexander Fedorov. Alexander stands 6'1", and when he's at his contest weight, he's at 280 pounds, which means that walking around today, he's about 320 pounds of solid rock muscle. He comes from St. Petersburg, Russia. His training style is a little bit different than the style of those guys here in the United States of America. He doesn't have a fancy gym membership, no. The gym in which Alexander Fedorov works out in is actually a graveyard. That's right, a cemetery. And there's a building there in St. Petersburg where the caretaker of the cemetery and all the such that goes on there, they come in and they change their clothes and they get their different tools and the things they need. He and his friends and his dad have set up a makeshift gym. All the equipment that they use is 20, 30, and 40 years of age. Oftentimes you can't even tell how much weight they're lifting because the numbers have been rubbed off from the wear. They just lift until it hurts, so to speak. The article in which I read about Alexander, it said that the walls of his gym are caked, not in millimeters, but in inches of mildew and mold. It stinks, it's dirty, it's cold, it doesn't have a heater. But in Las Vegas, Nevada, this October, Alexander Fedorov is going to get up on stage with the strongest, most sculpted men in all of the world. And we're going to see the difference. See, a couple months ago, Alexander came to the United States of America. Because he's such a large man and he is so good at what he does in the bodybuilding world, they toured him to all the great bodybuilding facilities, one of which is the mecca of bodybuilding, Venice, California. The place that Arnold Schwarzenegger put on the map, Mr. Olympia has hailed. Millions and millions and millions of dollars have been spent in this workout facility there in Venice Beach, California. They have the finest equipment. They have the finest trainers. They have the finest supplements. Anything you need and or want to promote bodybuilding, weightlifting, or any type of exercise, the place to go is Venice Beach, California. They've got it all. Every type of medication, every type of supplement, every type of equipment. A few months ago when he was being toured, he didn't say a whole lot. So afterwards, the reporter asked him, they said, Alexander, what did you think about Venice Beach? I mean, compared to where you work out, where there's mildew and mold and it's cold and you can't even see how much weight you're really lifting, what do you think about Venice Beach, California? To which he replied a very interesting quote. He said, I saw a lot of posing, but I didn't see a lot of lifting. I saw a lot of posing. I didn't see a lot of lifting. I've got a warning for those American guys who are going to compete against Alexander in 2 months. While you've been posing in front of a mirror, Alexander's been lifting. Folks, let me state that what he said about that gym in California can be said about a lot of our biblical studies and a lot of our theologies and a lot of our Christianity in America. We do a lot of posing. We don't do much lifting. Luke chapter 16. Jesus tells a story that shows us 2 men. One who posed and one who lifted. And what you're going to see in the end is an incredibly diametrically opposed difference in circumstances. Luke chapter 16, beginning in verse 19, it says, "There was a certain rich man, which was clothed in purple and fine linen, and he fared sumptuously every day. And there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, which was laid at the gate full of sores, and desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. It came to pass that the beggar died, was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried." Verse 23, "And in hell he lifted up his eyes, being in torments, he seeth Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried and he said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, Son, remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest thy good things and likewise Lazarus evil things. But now he is comforted and thou art tormented. And besides all this, between us and you, there's a great gulf fixed, so that they which would pass from hence to you cannot, neither can they pass to us that would come from thence. Then he said, I pray thee therefore, Father, that thou would send him my father's house. For I have five brethren, that he may testify unto them, lest they also come into this place of torment. Abraham said unto him, they have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. He said, no, Father Abraham, but if one went unto them from the dead, they will repent. He said unto him, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead." Two men, Lazarus and a, quote, certain rich man. Now, there are those who claim that what Jesus is telling us here is a parable. Simply put, a parable is a fictitious story that has truth or truths lying behind it. But let me state very clearly, this is not a parable. People claim that it's a parable because it says a certain rich man. I'll explain that in just a moment. Certain things I want you to understand are this. Jesus tells 33 parables that we have recorded in the four Gospels. In none of those parables does he use somebody's first name. Here he says Lazarus and Abraham. He uses the first names of two distinct people. In addition to that, in the other parables that Jesus tells, never do you have two characters that talk to each other within the parable. And here you have the rich man in hell and Abraham actually having a conversation. So the question becomes this: why would Jesus begin a certain rich man? Understand, much like the town we reside in, the world in which Jesus walked was not a very populated place. Everybody knew everybody's business. Here is the story about a man who most likely within the congregation had family and friends and business partners. Most likely he was recently deceased. Beyond that, Jesus did very specifically mention who he was. He said, you know, the certain rich man of which Lazarus begged at his gate. In other words, you know whose house I'm talking about. The guy where Lazarus was always there and the dog was always licking his sores. That's the guy I'm talking about. You say, well, why didn't he just give us his name? Because Jesus was a perfect gentleman. Even though he gives some harsh truth here, he didn't just say, oh, you know Joe Blow out there. He's in hell right now. He said, no, I'm going to let you figure this one out for yourself. There was a certain rich man that we all know. We all know where he lived. We all know what he did. But when you get down to it, unlike Lazarus, he did a lot of posing. It looked good. I'm sure he got up every morning in his makeshift mirror of some sort and he looked at what his clothes looked like. I'm sure he got his wallet out and he said, well, how fat is it today? He checked the business paper, so to speak. Everything in his life looked good in the mirror. But after he breathed his last breath, he found out he hadn't lifted anything. And here is a man by the name of Lazarus, who's doing nothing but lifting. He's lifting the pain of a body gone bad. He's lifting the pain of family not being around him. He's lifting the agony of having to sit at another man's door and hope that somehow, someway, the crumbs from his table can get to him before the dogs get it. Lazarus is doing a lot of lifting and no posing. But when the judgment comes for both of these men's lives, one finds himself in heaven. One finds himself in hell. which is the other issue I want to deal with before I get to the meat here, is this. In verse 23, it says, "And in hell he lifted up his eyes." Give me just a few moments to deal with a slight theological parenthesis here. Some of your Bibles at that point read the word Hades. Let me tell you what Hades is. Hades is a Greek word. Hell is an English word. All the other words in this story and all the other words are in English except for that one. And what some people have tried to convince myself and others is this, that to get the real, true, authentic meaning of this passage, you have to describe it as Hades. Let me tell you what these guys have done. And I mean no disrespect to guys who are smarter than me, who do a lot better job of translating, quote unquote, than I probably would. But I'm going to tell you what these guys have done. They are theological cowards, is what they are. Because they're afraid to tell you there is a hell. Folks, it's real. And as you can see from this story, it's hot. It's long. It's torment. And it's miserable. And when you say, oh, no, no, it's Hades. You know what Hades is? Hades is a Greek mythological term for the place of the dead that if you're good enough, you can get out eventually. Folks, that's not what Jesus is talking about. You know, I got a question here. It says Lazarus went to paradise. Why didn't they give us the Greek word for that? Why? Because everybody wants to talk about paradise. Everybody wants to talk about that. One day we'll get translated to this place where there's no more pain, there's no more hurt, there's no more crying, there's no more tears. We all want to talk about that. But we don't want to talk about hell much, do we? See, the reality of the matter is this. If you look at eternity, having been lived, having rejected the person of Jesus Christ, it is not a man-made invention called Hades. You say, well, Jeff, then why would you want to translate that word Hades into hell? And I'm going to tell you why. The Greeks had no concept of the hell Jesus was talking about. Later on in the Bible, you'll see sometimes the word Gehenna show up. It was literally a dump on the outside of town that smoldered with heat and stink. And Jesus used the word Gehenna. He used the word Hades to describe as graphically as he could these places of torment and pain. But to leave the word there is to do it a completely injustice. When you translate it, it is hell. Folks, the Greeks knew nothing of the hell Jesus preached about. They knew nothing of it. It is real and it is described here. Luke chapter 16, I want to focus this morning on this certain rich man. I want to do something, an interesting study this morning. I want to look at what a person experiences in hell. If you were to go to hell, what would it feel like? What would it look like? What would it smell like? What would it taste like? Let's begin with any of those five senses. Let's begin with the sense of feel. Look in verse 24. The very last statement made in verse 24 by the certain rich man. He says, I am tormented in this flame. The last word of verse 25, tormented. The last phrase of verse 28, place of torment. He describes that the environment in which he is in for all of eternity, this place called hell, is a place of torment. Folks, that word is not appealing. It means a place of agony. It means a place of pain. It means a place of literal torment. It says he's tormented in this flame. You know, oftentimes we hear the term hellfire brimstone preaching. That's what today is called. That word brimstone is found in the book of Genesis in dealing with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, where it talks about the fact that God rained brimstone and fire upon those cities. It's found in the book of Revelation three times. It's found in the book of Isaiah once, where it describes the fact that God rains down brimstone on those who reject him. So when it says here, I'm tormented in this flame, we get the idea of this hellfire, quote, brimstone preaching. Here's the interesting thing about brimstone. Brimstone, in our vocabulary today, is simply this, sulfur. Sulfur. Now, the summer before or after I graduated college and the summer before I went to seminary, I had a very dear friend of mine by the name of Wade Reed. Wade owns a company in the Dallas-Fort Worth area known as Hannon Hydraulics. Anytime you see these large major offshore drilling wells or heavy pieces of machinery, when the hydraulics break down, his company fixes it. They're the best in the country at it. He gave me the opportunity for a summer to work as a salesman for him. And the first couple of weeks that I was there, he had me pair up with other guys to get a feel of the rope, so to speak, before he sent me out on my own. One of the first couple of weeks that I was there, I was paired up with a guy by the name of Mike. We went down to a place called Glen Rose, Texas. It's the place where they have the famous dinosaur tracks and the nuclear power plant. We're going down there. We did not go to the nuclear power plant. We went to this other factory that was there. And we drove up and I noticed that there was a lot of things very different from this factory than a lot of the other factories that I'd been to. First off, all the roads were this grayish white ash look. It wasn't caliche, it wasn't rock, it wasn't pea gravel. It was just kind of a weird, almost like a fallout type of feeling. We go all the way up through these winding roads and we get up there and all the buildings have the same grayish, just blah look. But there is something of color that notices. That around every building there, there was this very large 2 or 2.5 inch diameter steel piping. It was a rail, so to speak, that was painted bright yellow. And it stood about 8 to 10 feet from every building. It went around every building that was on the campus. You could not approach a building, even the door, without first going through one of these bright yellow metal gates. On about every third or fourth cross member or post, there was a very large sign stating the reason why. We were at a factory that processed and implemented sulfur, what the Bible calls brimstone. And you may or may not be familiar with this, but when you burn sulfur, it burns clear. It's much like if you were to watch one of the auto races today, that alcohol is of such a high concentration, when it burns clear. But sulfur, when it burns, it is absolutely invisible to the eye. So when you're walking around this sulfuric plant, you have to be careful because if there's a fire that's come out of the building, you can't see it. You don't know it's there. So they have everybody stand back at least 8 to 10 feet. Here is a man being tormented in a fire he cannot see. Folks, that's horrible. Usually when we see a fire, it has a blue tint, a red tint, a yellow tint, or some type of tint. But here he is being tormented in a fire that he's probably anxiously desiring to get out of. He can't even see where it's coming from, where it's going. He cannot even see it. Which leads me to the second sense that he would have been experiencing, the sense of smell. You ever smelled sulfur? It's putrid. In fact, it probably goes up as one of the most disgusting smells on the planet. And I have two young kids. I know disgusting smells. And I'm telling you, sulfur is bad. When we went through that plant, we had to wear special masks because the fumes were so putrid. You know, I'm one of those Discovery Channel nuts. I admit it. I watch a lot of the Discovery Channel. Some of it's intelligent and some of it's very non-intelligent. There is a new show out that's hosted by a guy by the name of Mike Rowe entitled Dirty Jobs. Have y'all seen the promos or the show for that? What this guy does is he goes out and he finds people who have, quote unquote, dirty, filthy jobs. And he follows them all the day, learning how they do what they do, such as sewer inspectors. You know, not the cleanest job you've ever had. And people who take care of chickens on chicken ranches and all types of different disgusting, gross jobs. And what's interesting is if you've ever watched any clips of Mike Rowe on Dirty Jobs, in all of these really dangerously smelling situations, he always has a mask on. Why? To protect his lungs, to protect his esophagus, because some of those odors are lethal. You ever been in an environment where sulfur is being burned? Now, I'm going to tell you, I do have two small children. I spent a lot of my years in a locker room. There is no smell like the smell of sulfur burning. If you've never smelled it, it is the most putrid, gut-wrenching smell you've ever smelled in your life. And he says here, I am tormented in this flame. Not only is he being burned without perishing. In Mark chapter 8, Jesus makes the statement where the flame never goes out. In describing hell, not only is he being tormented, but he's being tormented by a flame that has such an odor that to our natural senses would literally burn the hair in your nostrils and the cilia in your lungs. It was putrid at best. Which moves us to the third sense. How about a sense of taste? Look at verse 24. He says, he cried out, he said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus.
that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. You know, there is a taste of being parched. I don't know if you've ever experienced that before, but have you ever been so thirsty that you get that taste in your mouth? Y'all know what I'm talking about, right? It's not a normal taste. You know, when you're thirsty, you're thirsty. But if you're so extremely thirsty, if you've ever been in the desert, you get this taste in your mouth that is just horrifying. A few years ago, I was participating in a youth camp. We were in White Sands, New Mexico. I don't know if you've ever been to White Sands, New Mexico. It is a desert in the middle of the mountains. It's really odd. You're like 7,000 feet elevation, but you're in the middle of the desert. Now, we took all these charter buses out there, and they said, for a couple hours, y'all are going to get to play and have a good time. So I'm out there with all those, you know, kids, and I'm trying to act like I can still play like a kid and having all kinds of fun. But I'll never forget, the guy by the name of Barry, who was hosting the camp, pulled us all together before we started. He goes, guys, I'm going to give you a warning. We'd been playing football and softball and all these other things. He said, you are in a desert. He said, you'll see mountains, you'll see snow in the background. It's going to trick your mind. Drink plenty of fluids. It didn't take long for these high school guys who thought they were tougher than nails to start get parched and dehydrated. It's interesting, if you've ever dealt with someone who's in the process of being dehydrated in that scenario, they'll talk about the taste that's in their mouth. There's this taste that forms. You get such a craving. You get such a hunger for water. You can actually taste the dryness in your throat. It's a weird, weird feeling. And yet here is this certain rich man. He's being tormented in a fire he can't see. He smells a smell that is so putrid, it's literally turning his soul on the inside out. And then he says, I am so thirsty. Just one drop of water. Now, folks, I'm going to be honest with you. I've never been that thirsty. I've asked for a cup of water. I've asked for a glass of water. I've never said, you know, just one drop will do me. That's how thirsty he was. Which moves us to the fourth sense, the sense of hearing. Look down in verse 31. Abraham makes this statement to him in response to his brothers. He says, and he said unto him, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead. In other words, what Abraham is stating to this man is simply this. He said, these guys have access to the writings of Moses. They have access to the writing of the prophets. They have access every day of their life to go down to the synagogue and to hear, quote unquote, how they can be saved. They're not hearing them. How will they hear if one rose from the dead? Which brings up something I want to show you is this. Here's a man, a certain rich man, who finds himself in a place the Bible calls hell. And you notice something he has? It's called memory. It's memory. Now, that's a complete antithetical thought to Revelation chapter 22. In Revelation chapter 21 and 22, when it says that you and I, as believers in Jesus Christ, when one day we'll enter what the Bible calls the new heaven, the new earth, and the new Jerusalem, it says on that day, all former things are past. In other words, it gives this description of all the junk of this life, all the pain of this life, all the misery of this life is somehow supernaturally, divinely by God erased. I don't know how it's going to happen. I can't explain it. It's like electricity. Don't know how it works, but I know how to turn it on. Same thing. And that's what takes place. Yet here's a man in hell who can remember five brothers. He can remember their spiritual condition. He can remember who Moses is. He can remember who the prophets are. Not only does he have a memory, he has a consciousness of what is taking place around him, which brings up the sense of hearing. Do you not know that the lessons of Moses, the lessons of the prophets, the lessons of the pastors, quote, that he would have sat under, were ringing in his ears for all of eternity. So you may be here this morning. This may be another day in your life that you reject Jesus. This may be another day that you go out the back door and say, I don't need that Jesus guy. Don't need him. Let me forewarn you that if you stay in that condition, If you stay hellbound till the day you breathe your last breath and you enter the place of hell, the message you're hearing right now will ring in your soul for all of eternity. You will hear over and over again, you were warned. You will hear over and over again, you knew how to get out with the person of Jesus. You will think, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, I had the opportunity, I had the opportunity, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it. I'm going to tell you what, you may not like my preaching, but some of you may hear it forever in hell. As it rings over and over and over. He was constantly reminded of the message he was rejected. He was constantly reminded of the truth he said no to. He was constantly reminded of all the opportunities to give his life to God. And he said no every time. He's tormented in a flame. There's a stench around him. There's a taste in his mouth from the dryness. And there's this constant ringing in his soul of what he didn't do when he should have. Which brings me to the worst sense he could have had and did. It's the sense of sight. Look in verse 23. It says, in hell, he lifted up his eyes, being in torment, and he seeth Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. We're about to touch on one of the fewest aspects preached upon about the concept and the reality of hell, and it is this. According to Luke 16, which is not a parable, which is a story, a life story of an account of two men, one who posed and one who lifted, Jesus tells us that the man who is in hell can see what's going on in heaven. He can literally see across the gulf. He can't cross it. He can't pass it. But he can see Lazarus. He can see Abraham. He can see where he could have gone, and he didn't. Let me tell you the worst part about hell. The worst part about hell is not the fire. The worst part about hell is not the smell. The worst part about hell is not the taste. And the worst part about hell is not hearing mine or someone else's preaching for all of eternity. The worst part of hell is being in the fire, smelling the sulfur, tasting the lack of water, hearing the preaching over and over again, and at the same time, seeing those who are in heaven. That's the worst part about hell, is you get a 24-hour day, 7 days a week movie of those who accepted Jesus and the reward thereof it, while you experience the pain and the agony that you're in for all of eternity. The worst sense of hell is this. The fact that you see where you could have gone and you didn't. You see where others went and you didn't. You see and you see and you see. And you hear and you hear and you hear and you taste and you smell and you feel and all of those things that we know like today on earth last for all of eternity. Folks, in summary, hell is a real place. It's not fiction. It's not made up. A group of pastors didn't get together a couple of years back and say, hey, I tell you what, why don't we just go and scare the daylights out of them? Talk about this hell place. No, hell's real. Jesus talked about it twice as much as he did heaven. Why? Because he doesn't want you to go there. Hell is real. Hell is hot. Hell is not fun. But here's the thing you need to learn today, to learn from the life of Lazarus, one who lifted and didn't pose. You don't have to go there. You do not have to go to hell. As Jesus explained over and over and over again, he simply stated this. He said, all who come unto me. Jesus made the statement, if you believe, you will be saved. All throughout Scripture, it says that the antidote or the cure for hell is Jesus Christ. There is no other cure. You can try to be good enough. You can try to go to church. It won't matter. The ultimate cure for avoiding hell is Jesus. He is the only key out. In fact, in Revelation chapter 1, it says he has the key to death. He has the key to hell. Jesus Christ is the only one who can keep you from this eternity that we've described this morning. Jesus Christ promised life. Jesus Christ promised peace. Jesus Christ promised an eternity of a place called heaven. Why would you choose what this rich man chose? So what is stopping you? The same thing that kept this man out of heaven and in hell. Pride. An unwillingness to admit who you really are and what you're really doing and where you really stand with God.